Hi, I'm Allison, an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is June 5th, 1993. And my home group is the Tuesday night Buckingham Big Book Group. We're a step meeting. We meet at 8 o'clock on Tuesday nights. And if you're ever in Buckingham or want to come, come with the Hills. They come. They bring a van. I want to thank Billy for asking me to come here. They do so much with our group, and the drive really just isn't that bad, and I'm happy to come do it. It's always kind of an honor to be asked to do anything. And we were talking, we had a conversation coming up in the car, and I was telling Merle that when I first got married, I think I was 9 months sober, and I thought because I was a wife now, I only had time to go to AA maybe once or twice a week, you know, and that lasted about a month, and after that, I was probably homicidal. My husband was ready to kill me, too. I mean, it was just nuts. I got absolutely stark, raving nuts, and I found out that, you know, sometimes I think I don't have enough time to go to all these meetings or do all this stuff. And when I do go to all these meetings and do all this extra stuff, I accomplish more. You know, I didn't have much to do yesterday. It was sort of a free day. And I laid around. You know, I might have done a load of laundry. Today I knew I was coming here. I'm studying for an exam, and I studied for like 4 hours, got tons of stuff done around the house, watched a football game, and now I'm here. You know, it's weird how it works that way for me. I think the more I give, the more my life just is better. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm originally from upstate New York. I lived there for the first 13 years of my life until I got kicked out of my house. And my mother kicked me out, and I got sent. That's how I ended up in Virginia living with my dad. My first drunk took place when I was 13, and I was in New York. And I had a lot of consequences from that. I was taken home in an ambulance. I was just vomiting all over the place. I was rambling on about how awful my life was. You know, I was 13 years old, and it was crazy. And I was with a girlfriend and two boys, and somebody got a fake ID and bought a 12-pack of beer, and we stole what alcohol was in some of our parents' homes. And my mom's not a big drinker, so I don't think I got much from her home. And anyway, I had 4 Molson Goldens, a flask of vodka, and a flask of Burgundy. And, you know, it's interesting. My mom and my aunt was visiting us, and when I got taken home in the ambulance, my mom and my aunt had to stay up all night with me while I was throwing up. And just, I don't remember much. I had a, you know, an immediate blackout. But I do remember a little bit before all that set in. And I, you know, before I ever took a drink, I definitely had the condition known as alcoholism. You know, I was very selfish and self-centered. I was a liar and a thief from really early on. My mom, when she went to bed at night, had to lock her door, and she took herself and her purse with her. And, you know, I stole money from her. And we didn't have a lot of money after my parents got divorced. I mean, we had almost no money. People had to help us pay our mortgage. My mom had to get food stamps, and we got the subsidized lunch at school. And I remember being really embarrassed about that and just hating her, for our demise. And, you know, it wasn't her fault. She was working a lot. She was trying to support 2 kids being a single mom, and I was one of the most ungrateful children. And I just couldn't stand her. I walked around feeling inadequate. I blamed her for everything. I'd look at what other kids had and just really resent her so much for not being able to give us what these other people had. And I was very into thinking that what somebody had on the outside was really the measure of how they were doing on the inside. And you know, in sobriety, I found out that's wrong, even with myself. I can look very good and be just dying inside. So anyway, at a real young age, I felt inadequate. I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. I just felt really awkward. I was very afraid of people, yet I craved the attention of people. And I didn't know what to do to get it, so I ended up doing a lot of inappropriate things to get attention. I acted out a lot in school and at home. I got a lot of negative attention. I was grounded a lot. I was spanked a lot. I got in trouble at school a lot. There was always conferences, so I did get attention. It just wasn't probably the right kind of attention. And this night that I got drunk, for a while before everything hit the fan, I felt great. Oh my gosh, I remember the feeling. The book talks about men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And my husband always says if he could change any word, he would say they love the effect produced by alcohol. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I felt pretty. I felt funny. I felt like I could connect with you. I knew I was going to do it again. And there was no question in my mind. And you know, I did. But most people, if they're a social drinker, if that happens to them, they are not going to do it again. They are going to wake up in the morning and feel awful. They're going to say, oh, God, I'm in so much trouble, because I was grounded for a long time. Wasn't allowed to hang around friends. The whole neighborhood heard this ruckus that I created when I was drunk. So some of my friends' parents were telling them they could not hang around me. That started happening. I was beginning to be an undesirable. And it, you know, all that, while I felt bad, I did feel bad inside, I knew I would drink again because I loved what it did for me. It was just, it was like magic, really. Everything that seemed to bother me was gone for that short period of time. I didn't care that we were on welfare. I didn't care that other people had better clothes than me. I just didn't care. It's funny what alcohol does. I've heard it described by other people, and I relate it to myself, where I can go into the evening feeling very inadequate with regard to being next to you, and then, you know, have a few, and I feel better than you. I feel like you would be lucky to be in my shoes. You know, it's that significant of a change that my, you know, my perception does. And so for a short window of time, I got that perception of change, and you know, the rest of the night was a bust. It was awful. And I remember waking up the next morning, and I felt horrible. I think I was sick well into the morning, and you know, my mom coming up to me in my room and letting me know what my consequences were going to be. And she talked to me about alcohol. My father is in our program. He doesn't mind me saying that. And I can't keep track. I don't think he was drinking at the time, but, you know, that was a significant reason why my parents' divorce was his drinking. I remember when I was a little girl, he would be gone for days at a time. My parents used to have horrendous fights, the kind that the whole neighborhood heard about, you know, that you could hear it if you opened your window. And I remember being embarrassed about that and feeling real insecure living in that environment. I don't think I ever told myself when I grew up I'm not going to drink like my dad. But my mom that morning came in and gave me a big lecture about alcohol and alcoholism. And, you know, you don't want to end up like that and all this stuff. My dad's one of those people, when he drinks, he loses everything, including his home. And you know, he does. And, you know, alcoholics, I look at stuff that happens to you, and I can be doing the same thing that you're doing, but I will not think it's going to happen to me, too. I'm a smoker, and I don't like that I'm a smoker. And, you know, Peter Jennings just died of lung cancer. And in my mind, I can think, God, I got to quit smoking. Look at all these people are getting lung cancer. But then I secretly think, you know what? It's a 50-50 chance. Maybe I'll get it. Maybe I won't. That's how I was with my alcoholism. I would look at the destruction that it wreaked around me and think, well, you know what? If I play my cards right, I won't suffer these consequences. And sometimes I did, and a lot of times I suffered worse consequences. But my mom gave me this big, huge lecture on alcohol and what will happen if I continue drinking and all this stuff. And when you're 13 years old, it goes in one ear and right out the other. And I had already been exposed to what it did for me. And so I knew. I mean, by then it was a moot point. I knew I would do it again. And I did. You know, I didn't start drinking every day or every weekend back then. I couldn't. I didn't have the resources. I was too young. We couldn't get it all the time. In the end of my drinking, though, I was a daily drinker. I was a morning drinker. I was hoping that I would not wake up the next morning. I was suicidal. It was nuts. I couldn't hold a job. So, you know, something happened between me being 13 and then 27 ending up in that bind. And I'm not going to go into every sordid story, but I got kicked out of my mother's house. Not so much of my drinking, but I was physically abusive to my mom. I was a very angry woman. And when I came into AA, I was really angry, and I didn't even realize how angry I was. If you had asked me when I came in here and stayed to describe myself, I thought I was really nice. I thought I was considerate. I was not at all. I was very deceitful, selfish, self-serving. I would be friends with you if I could get something from you. You had to be able to do something for me in order for me to even talk to you or give you the time of day. And that's a horrible way to be. And now it doesn't really matter what I can get from people as long as I can give them something. But I had no idea how angry I was. And my mom and I were clashing, and good for her for kicking me out of the house. I had a big blowout party when she was gone for a weekend, and she had a neighbor checking up on me, and she was home the next day, and that was a Saturday, and on Sunday I was on a plane to Virginia. There was no, you know, long drawn out discussion. She had it with me. And I remember her telling me, you know, she knew what a liar I was. She was so angry at me and had every right to be. I took advantage of her. I called her horrible names. I was not nice to my mother at all. If I could single out one person who got hurt the most in my drinking, it was probably my mother. And oddly enough, my mother stayed on my resentment list for 12 years, which is just weird. But anyway, she called my father and told him, you know, it's your turn. And he already had my brother. He had gotten him the year prior to that for other reasons, which I don't need to discuss. That's his deal. And anyway, my dad was a military man. He was very strict. And at this point, he was not drinking. And I remember getting off the plane, and he told me, you know, you're living in my house. You're going to live by my rules. I heard you're smoking cigarettes. You're not going to do that. And, you know, just all this stuff that I wasn't going to do. Within 2 weeks, I was doing all of it. I was stealing his cigarettes. I was sneaking out of the house. I'd fallen, you know, water seeks its own level, and alcoholics seek each other, and we find each other. And no matter where I went, I met up with one of you. I don't know how that works, but it works. And so my best friend in high school was definitely one of us, and she and I ran together, and we got in all kinds of trouble together. Both our parents forbid us to see each other. We got in a horrible car accident when I was 17 and almost got killed, and then 2 months after that, I got arrested for driving while intoxicated. That's how old I am. It was called a DWI, and not a DUI, and that's the only time that ever happened to me. I don't know how. I drove all around the Northern Virginia area intoxicated out of my mind. I remember hitting a old person's, you know, some family's mailbox one night, just going right up on the curb, knocking the mailbox out, and still driving home in blackouts. I remember driving from Manassas to Arlington on Route 66 in a blackout, and it scares me today to think about it, and now I get scared being on the road late at night, because I know there's drunk drivers, and I used to be one of them, and I think about how fortunate I am that nothing ever happened to me or anybody else, God forbid. But I drove like that every day, just every day. I became a daily drinker in college. I can't believe it. I got accepted to a college. It was the only one I got accepted to, and I went. I could not wait to get out of the house. It was just horrible. My whole high school days are just, I was grounded more my junior year than I wasn't. You know, I was drinking every weekend. I was dating the biggest speed dealer in the county. I mean, it was just, you know, that's the history. That's those 4 years. That's what I did. And it was just a constant battle with my father searching my room and grounding me and me swearing I'd never do it again and then doing it again. I started lying about my drinking and hiding it from the gates. I didn't even know to hide my drinking. Nobody ever told me about hiding drinking. I just did that naturally. And I hid it in duffel bags. I hid it everywhere. When I started driving, I'd hide it in my car. I mean, it was crazy. I remember getting pulled over for speeding, and I was drunk, and I must have had 72 beer cans in my car, and the policeman looked in. It was 8 in the morning, and he said, you know, ma'am, I'm going to trust this is from last night or the weekend before, and I said, okay, and, you know, just went on my merry little way, and I would go to the dumpster, like, at, you know, 1, 2 in the morning so nobody would see all my beer cans, and these are people I don't even know, and why do I care what they think, but it was nuts. I mean, that's how I'd go to different stores. I had my whole round of 7-Elevens that I would go to because I didn't want anybody thinking I drank too much. And it was crazy. And nobody ever told me to do that. I just intuitively knew how to do it. And I did get accepted to college, and that's when my drinking became a daily event. And I never stopped. You know, that never ended. I drank pretty much every single day. I would steal in order to drink. I would forge checks. I would bounce them. It did not matter. I had to have alcohol. My college roommate introduced me to the morning drink, and that was my favorite time to drink. It's no wonder I enjoy coffee in the morning now. It's my favorite time of the day. And it was when I was drinking. And I, my first semester at Longwood, I think my grade point average was like a point something. It was just horrible. And when I came home for Christmas, my dad told me that if I did not maintain a C average, then I could forget school and start working because he wasn't going to pay for me to do all that stuff. And in at Longwood, my drinking got very dark. That's when I started waking up places I didn't remember going to with people I didn't even know their name. I got kicked out of several places. One time in the winter, I passed out in the middle of a field with no coat, nothing on. I woke up the next morning, or actually by now I was coming to, and I don't even remember what happened. And it scared me. But obviously it didn't scare me enough to make me quit drinking. I tell you, drunks are hard to scare. You can tell us we're going to die tomorrow, but we'll think we might just beat the odds, like I was talking about earlier. And I was very scared and embarrassed of my behavior, but I was not willing to do anything about it, certainly not quit drinking. My solution for being so embarrassed was to change schools. The last week of my time at Longwood, I really did it up, and to the point where I was so embarrassed I couldn't even go into the dining hall and eat. I had my college roommate bring me salad in a big 7-Eleven big gulp cup, and I just wouldn't go down there for 5 days. I stayed holed up in my room. I went out to take my finals, and then the day that I was free, I packed up all my stuff, and I knew I wasn't coming back. I didn't tell anybody. I acted like, oh, I'll see you next year, all that kind of stuff. I couldn't tell them. I knew they would confront me, and I already had my plan in place. When I got back, I told my dad that Longwood wasn't for me. There's just too much partying that goes on there, and it distracts me from my studies. I mean, what a bunch of crap. And I don't know why. I think parents want to believe their kids, and my dad wanted to believe that I could change. And I enrolled at George Mason, and I did not last there. I think I lasted there a semester, and I did okay. And then I started going to the campus bar, and I never made it to class. It was just, at least my experience is that at some point in our drinking, Bill Wilson talks about it, alcohol becoming our master. And it truly was mine at a very early age, because by then I was only 20, 21, I think. I don't even know if all, you know, I was probably way alcoholic before I was even legally allowed to drink. And alcohol truly was my master. It dictated everything. It made all my decisions. My parents brought me up to have values, morals, all that stuff, and I wanted to have them, and I think maybe way early on I did have a few, but the longer it went on with drinking, and the longer I went on just being such an angry woman, all that stuff went out the window. You know, I used to tell myself, maybe I'll cut back on drinking if this happens, and then whatever it was would happen, and I'd say, okay, if this happens, then I'll really stop. And, you know, I kept having to lower the bar for myself. By the end of my drinking, I didn't have any code that I lived by. It didn't matter. Even if I loved you, I would steal from you because I had to have a drink. My withdrawals were very bad. I used to get physically ill. I dropped out of school, obviously. That wasn't working out. And, you know, I really wanted an education. And I know my parents wanted me to have an education. And that was important to me, but obviously alcohol was more important to me. I could not do both. I just couldn't do both. And so the only alternative was to start working so I could support my drinking habit. And that's what I did. And by now I'm a morning drinker. And that doesn't do well in the workforce. It was crazy. I lived with my father, and that didn't last very long because obviously I could not drink the way I wanted to. That's when I started hiding it in the hamper. I hid it in a Nike gym bag. I'd hide it in the closets, and every day I came home, I would get confronted. You know, I found this today. He's holding in his hand, and I thought, oh, good Lord. And I used to say, you know, well, I'm 21 or 22, whatever I was, and he said, well, if you're living in my house, you're going to live by my rules. And so, obviously, what did I do? I moved. And I answered an ad, and I moved to Fairfax with these women I didn't even know, and shared a townhouse with them, and my routine was I would go to work. Well, actually, my real routine was I'd come to around 3 or 4 in the morning. I'd finish off what I saved in my room. I probably wouldn't take a shower. I'd put makeup on over last night's makeup. I'd get dressed, didn't iron anything, and I'd go to work thinking that was normal, you know, and wondering why people looked at me when I came in the morning looking the way I did and smelling the way I did, you know, both of alcohol and just bad hygiene. And I never worked anywhere very long. You know, that's no surprise. I would give myself these little pep talks, and I would say, okay, you know, tomorrow's a new day. You can do this. You're not going to drink when you get up. You're going to go to work. You're going to do a full day's work, an honest day's work. People aren't going to smell alcohol in your breath. By now, it was coming out of my pores. And that never happened. It's not that I didn't want to. I was unable to. I would get up in the morning, and my withdrawal was so bad, my whole body would be shaking. And the only way I knew to take that away was to start drinking. And I always made sure that I had enough to get me through the morning. And then I'd drink on my lunch breaks. And then I'd stop at 7-Eleven on the way home, get another 12-pack, and do the whole deal again. My roommates caught on to my drinking, and I'll tell you how. I mean, I'm sure they knew, but this was how I knew they knew, is I told you I was, I hid my beer cans, and I'd hide them in my car, I'd hide them in my closet, all kinds of stuff, and I thought I was really sneaky, and that's another thing. We come here, we think we're so sneaky, and we find out that everybody knew what was going on all along. And one of my roommates called me at work, and she said, are you okay? And of course, I'm going to lie. I said, sure. You know, what do you mean? Everything's fine. And she said, well, you know, I went into your closet to borrow a sweater, and all these beer cans came flying out of the closet, and I just was mortified. And my solution to that was to move the next weekend. That was my solution. I got an apartment that I couldn't afford, but I was going to live alone so I could have peace and quiet, and my God, I deserved it, and I was going to drink. And that's what I did. And that started the whole eviction from apartments, all the lights being turned off, the no phone, almost having my car repossessed because I couldn't afford it. But it was more important to me to be able to drink in peace and quiet than to stop and think, you know, maybe my life is not going the way I planned it because of this. And by then, family members were confronting me. I've always been very close with my brother. And I remember he came to me one time almost in tears, and he said, you know, what are you going to do, Allison? Be a house drunk all your life? Is that what you're going to be? I think I was drinking a beer. It was 10 in the morning. I looked at him, and I'm sure I said, no, you know, this is just, you know, what's wrong with this? It's the weekend. I always thought it was okay to drink in the morning on the weekends. That was my philosophy. And but I still remember that, and that was like 20 years ago he said that. And my mom would just cry. She was just, oh, God, she was mortified. I wouldn't come home for Christmas. I wouldn't call. I wouldn't come home for Thanksgiving. I wouldn't call. I wouldn't call on birthdays. I didn't even remember your birthdays. One of the things I did when I was drinking was I played drunk and dial. I'd call you up at like midnight, 1, 2, 3 in the morning, and I'd cuss you out and tell you how you've ruined my life. A lot of times I didn't even know who called me till I got the phone bill. No wonder my phone got cut off. It was like $400 a month. I don't know who I was calling, but I was calling a lot of people. You know, it was just nuts the way I was living, and everybody in my family was sick of it. Luckily, Oddly enough, neither my mother nor my father lent me a dime. They knew better. And my mom knew she was never going to get it back, and my dad knew the same thing. And they never once, and I needed rent, so, you know, I called them up in tears. I'm going to be evicted from my apartment. Well, honey, that's too bad, but I'm sure you'll find a way out of it. And that was the end of the conversation. And I say, good for them, because, you know, the longer, if they had started giving me money, oh, God, that would just continue the irresponsibility. It was just nuts. I would use people dry until I could no longer use them anymore, and then I'd have to start using other people. I was definitely a real user and a taker, and I had nothing to give anyway, but even if I had, I wouldn't have thought of giving it up to you. And so, you know, that it was just a chaotic, unbelievable way to live. And there's a part in our book that says, to the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And it was. You know, I didn't like it, but that was my routine. Get up, start drinking, take a shower, maybe yes, maybe no, go to work, maybe yes, maybe no. I was a real caller in sicker. I remember I got caught at one place. I told them the same grandmother died twice. I did all that kind of stuff, you know. It was just crazy. Now when I look at my life, I think, oh, my God, how did I even survive? It's amazing any of us survived what we did. But I did. You know, to me, that was my life. That was the life I knew. It certainly was not the life I had carved out for myself, but it was the life I knew, and that was normal to me. I didn't know anything about paying your bills. I didn't even know how to balance a checkbook. I didn't know any of that. I didn't know about going to the grocery store, buying your groceries, doing laundry, cleaning your house. I remember one time I had somebody coming over, and I noticed the bathroom was dirty, and I got a little sponge from my kitchen and sprayed some Windex on it and cleaned the bathroom floor. I didn't know. I did not know you get a mop, you do all that stuff. That's not how I lived. And one thing, I started on a routine of treatment centers. I've been to four, and I've been to psychiatrists, I've been to psychologists. I started that very early on. You know, my parents would send me to all sorts of therapy. I've been to family therapy, I've been to group therapy, individual therapy. I lied to everybody. I lied to them all. And in the treatment centers, I remember what propelled me into the first one was my godmother calling me at 4 a.m. She had to have set her alarm for this. And she called me at 4 a.m. and she said, the reason I'm calling you this early is because I'm hoping you'll be sober. And I thought, oh, my God. So usually people knew I drank in the morning. And if you get me at 5 a.m., chances are I've had a couple. And she just went off, and just, I really love my godmother, and I looked up to her, and we were very close at that time in my life, and I didn't want to let her down. I don't know what, I mean, I'm definitely an approval seeker, and so, that's how I ended up in my first treatment center. Somehow she wrangled a promise out of me that I would call one, and if I didn't call one, I would allow her to call one. Anyway, I was going. I was going, and like within 2 days' time, I was going, and I went to one in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and I always get it confused, Harrisburg or Harrisonburg. Thank you. And I was there for 28 days. I broke all the rules. I remember my counselor there looking at me, and by, you know, people, it's funny. I remember in the beginning when I started breaking all the rules, I'm very defiant and very stubborn. You know, he would spend all this time with me and beg with me and plead with me, and by the end of my duration there, he was so disgusted with me. When I broke a rule, it was like, oh, big deal. You know what? You're going to pay the price later. And he looked at me. It was my last day there. And he said, you know, people like you don't get sober at all. And I looked at him, and I was shocked. And here I am, you know, breaking all those rules. And I asked him why. And I kind of liked him, actually. And he said, because you're just so dishonest. He said, you will never, ever get sober until you are able to see yourself for who you really are. Something along those lines. And I thought, screw you, I was mad. And I thought, well, whatever. And, you know, it must have made an impression on me because I remember that too. And And at first I kind of thought, who does he think he is telling me I'm not going to get sober? And you know what? At that time in my life, he was 100% correct. I was drunk within 2 hours of leaving that treatment center. I didn't even try. It wasn't, you know, and it's not that I did not get good information there. I did. I got great information. I went to lots of meetings. I was, it was not the first time I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got introduced to AA in high school after getting in that bad car accident, but obviously I didn't stay. I went to one meeting. And so this is the first time I was introduced to it more than one day, you know, with a few meetings in succession. And I didn't want to get sober. I just didn't want to get sober. I'm convinced now it doesn't matter what brings you here. It really doesn't matter. Where what matters is what keeps you here, you know? I mean, I literally, the last time I got sober, hopefully the last time I got sober 12 years ago, I was afraid that my husband was going to kick me out of the house. You know, that is not an honest desire to stop drinking by any stretch of the imagination. But then when I got here, I started doing stuff. I didn't like AA immediately. I hated it, as a matter of fact. I hated all the ladies. I hated all the men. Al was my only friend. And some days I didn't like him either. I thought, God, he's an AA nut. But somehow along the line, something became very hopeful to me. Something you all were doing became very attractive to me. It was much better than the way I was leading my life. So I don't think it matters what gets people here. I think what, you know, something needs to happen in order for me to stay here. But what brings me here is whatever brings me here. And so the first treatment center I went to was because my godmother threatened me. And I wanted her approval. So there you have it. And that just started a line of them. I would go to detoxes. I would go to other treatment centers. And I kept looking for somebody to fix me. And I didn't realize, you know, I've been through our book. It took me several years in sobriety to do it, but I have been through it. And now I see all through there where it says no human power can relieve our alcoholism. And boy, I was begging human people to relieve my alcoholism. Institutions to relieve my alcoholism. I got to a point, both my parents have told me in sobriety they thought I was going to end up being locked up or I was going to kill myself. And obviously, luckily, none of that happened, but I really wanted somebody to fix me. By the time I got sober, I actually, my last drunk was in Buckingham County. I did stay dry in Arlington, Virginia for 2.5 years, and this is worth noting, because I see this happen a lot, and I go through it still sometimes. It was after one of my treatment centers, I think, and I decided, I met some people in AA that I liked, and all of a sudden AA became this real social scene for me. There was a lot of young people. I was probably, I think, 23 or so back then. And it became very social. I'd go to certain meetings. I went to a meeting every day. In a big city, there's all kinds of meetings around the clock. And I'd see certain people at this meeting, certain people at this meeting. I got a sponsor. I called her every morning at 11:30. I lied to her. I was taking a lot of actions. And nothing changed. And I couldn't understand why, you know. And I was still stealing. I was lying on my timesheet at work. I was fudging it so I could afford this apartment that I really couldn't afford. It was crazy. And I wanted certain clothing and all this stuff. And so I was very deceitful and spiritually sick on the inside. I didn't even know it. I thought that as long as I came to meetings and didn't drink, things would change. And you know what? I will say this. My health did change. My health got immediately better once I stopped drinking the amount I was drinking. And I felt better physically. You know, I did. But my experience with that was that at some point, I'm going to have to do more than just not drink and go to meetings. And so what happened to me during this 2.5 years was horrendous. I got in, I think, $20,000 worth of credit card debt, which I took me 8 years in sobriety now to pay off, and it was nuts. I mean, it may have even been more than 20. My car was completely illegal. I got so many tickets I couldn't afford to pay. They suspended my license. I couldn't afford to go. Oh, it was nuts. I couldn't afford driving insurance, so I was driving around without insurance. I got caught for that. It was nuts. On the outside, I looked like a very nice person. I was going to work every day. That changed. You know, I held down a job. People at my job liked me. And, you know, meanwhile, back at the ranch, I'm stealing from them. And so I was living the classic double life. I wanted you to think a certain way of me, and deep down I knew I didn't deserve it. I was definitely not a good example. I didn't know about the steps. I'm sure people were talking about them, but I sure as heck wasn't receptive to them. I didn't know what to do, and I started getting so edgy and so agitated because I knew, I couldn't explain it to you then, I know now. I mean, everything I was doing was conflicting. You know, on one hand, I'm going to these meetings acting like, oh, you know, I'm not drinking, everything's great. And then the next thing you know, I'm running up $20,000 of credit card debt because I'm so spiritually sick, I need that to fill the hole. And I see it happen all the time. People fill the hole with shopping, sex, you name it. We've all run the gamut. There's not too many ways to fill the hole, I've decided. And, you know, you take your pick and go fill it. And I took my pick, and my pick was shopping and men. And that's what I did. And, you know, that stuff will make you feel good for an hour, 10 minutes, whatever. But it always has to go away, and then you have to do it some more, and do it some more, and do it some more. So here I am, without a drink, going to meetings, making coffee at meetings and stuff, and acting so horrible that I just couldn't stand myself. And I got to that jumping off place again. I felt like the drowning man the book talks about. I felt as though quicksand was just coming up around me, and actually, it's also described as irritable, restless, and discontent. You know, when I'm starting to live not according to the values that I've set up for myself, I'm going to be real agitated. Anything anybody does, I'm going to snap at. When I'm on a dry one, I'm very judgmental. Nothing is my fault. It is all your fault. I was just very negative. And I was on a date one night, and I had a beer, and there you go. And that set off 6 months of the darkest drinking that I'd ever had. When the last treatment center I went to, my landlord actually, I think, called my dad. Somebody did, because I wouldn't come out of my apartment. I wouldn't come to work. I was just hoping that I was going to drink enough that I would not wake up and just die. I was so tired. I do remember that. When I got to AA finally, I was exhausted. I was absolutely physically, mentally, spiritually, all of it. I was absolutely exhausted. And I didn't want to live that way anymore. I was scared not to drink, and I was scared to drink. It was really weird. And I think the book talks about that, too. Anyway, during this dry time, I met who is now my husband. I remember during this dry time calling my brother and telling him I wanted to kill myself. And I did lots of stuff to get attention inappropriately, and that was one of them. And it was, God works in really funny ways. I at least my God has an incredible sense of humor. And my brother spits out of his mouth, "You know, Allison, my boss is in AA." And I thought, oh, no. You know, that's not what you want to hear. You want some empathy, and it'll be okay. You want me to come sit with you and all this stuff. And he did not say that. And he said, "My boss is in AA, and he's going to this big book thing in Maryland this weekend. And, I'll, you know, if he can get you in, will you go? And what are you going to do?" And so I thought, oh, no. And I remember, I was not quite willing, but I told my brother, okay, I can't go Friday, but I will go Saturday. And I thought, oh, gosh. And I did. And that was the first time. I had several big books. I got a big book every time I got admitted to a treatment center. So, you know, I had four packed in my house already. And I went to this big book study. I had to actually unpack one of the books to go. And here I am, dry in AA, and I got to unpack a big book. And so I went to this, and it's the first time I knew the steps. The directions to our program of recovery were in this book. And, you know, I wish I could say it happened differently, but that's the way it happened. And I remember being enthralled by what these men, it was a Joe and Charlie thing, and I'd never heard anything like this in my life. Where I went to Northern Virginia meetings, it was all don't drink, go to meetings, and it'll be okay. My experience said, I'm not okay. I was just dying inside. And, you know, that obviously I got drunk again, but a seed had been planted. I knew there was something to do here. I had never heard that before. I'm sure plenty of people told me, but I hadn't heard it. And now, you know, it's funny, I sponsor a few women today, and sometimes, you know, people just hear when they hear, and they see when they can see. And I'm sure people had told me a lot of stuff, and I just wasn't able to hear it. But I was really enthralled by what these men were talking about, that there were actually things to do, and you would get better. And I had never really heard it quite that way. And so anyway, my last drunk was obviously June 4th, 1993, and Neil and I were living together, and I was probably 9 months dry and hating everything about it. I hated AA in that area. By then I lived in Buckingham, and oh, the women were awful, and the men are awful, and everything's awful. I was unemployable. I had all this debt. I was so overwhelmed. Not doing anything, by the way, but, you know, and everything, that was my theme. It was all about me. And I woke up one morning at 9 a.m. and thought, I'm going to get drunk. It didn't even, you know, I had no foundation in place to stop that. I had no relationship with the God of my understanding. I had nothing. Our book says there will be a time in every alcoholic's career or life or whatever you want to call it that they'll have no mental defense against the first drink. Our defense must come from a higher power. I didn't have that relationship. I didn't have any kind of defense. I woke up, said, I'm getting drunk, and I went out and got the beer. That was it. That was the train of thought. I don't really think about why I got drunk. I believe I got drunk because I wanted to get drunk. I wanted the effect produced by alcohol, and that's about as far as I go with it. I called my husband at work, told him I was drunk. I mean, what a selfish, self-centered thing to do. You know, here's somebody who is actually working for a living, and I'm calling him and telling him that I'm drunk. I'm running up a phone bill at his house. It was just crazy. He did come home and get all the cash, and he was good for him, and he offered to get me more alcohol. And I looked at him, and I, in a snotty little way, I'll get it if I need it, you know. And he just really didn't want me to drive drunk. And I came to that night, and I had probably the first honest surrender I had ever had in my whole life. I've had several since, but at least to alcohol. I came to in my living room, and I remember looking through the book and talking to myself, and, you know, I used to do all those, God, please help me, and I'll never do it again, and I was even sick of me. I was even sick of saying that stuff. I was so disgusted with myself, I was tired of listening to me, and I just remember saying that, you know, if there is a God, then I'm okay, I will try it. I have nowhere else to go. I have, nobody else will take me, kind of, one of those. I knew that it was over. I knew the jig was up, and I knew that even if I hated AA, you were the only people who kept welcoming that. Nobody else was welcoming me back. My family wasn't talking to me by now. They were so disgusted. They would get so excited every time they'd hear I was in AA, and you know what happened? I'd get drunk. And so even they got to the point where they didn't think I was ever going to get sober. Everything that came out of my mouth was a lie. It was crazy. I had no job, no income, no nothing. And I knew that I could not continue living the way I was living, but I was terrified to try something different. Now, that's a little bit insane. It just is. I know the truth about my drinking today. You know, it was funny. I was saying this to Al the other day. Usually in the summertime, we have lots of relatives come. That's when we see them. And fortunately, this summer, they have actually driven out to our house, which is really nice, especially considering the cost of gas. And I have a grandfather who drinks. I mean, he doesn't drink a lot, but he drinks. And they were coming over for dinner, and I never buy alcohol, and it was really weird, and I thought, well, I guess I ought to get them a bottle of wine, because they all drink, and I bought it, and it turned out they brought their own, nice of them, and I told Al, you know, I was cleaning out the refrigerator the other day, there's still the unfinished bottle that they brought with themselves, and the whole bottle I brought, and they forgot to take it with them, and it's sitting in my fridge, and I didn't even remember, and I thought, well, I'm just going to give this to my neighbor. And, you know, when I was drinking, I knew every ounce of alcohol that I had. If I only had 2 beers left, I got scared. I've scrounged my cabinets for vanilla extract because I've run out of beer before, and I've drank the extract. But I know that the 10-step promises have come true to me, at least in that respect, with regard to alcohol. I am totally neutral towards alcohol today. I'm not saying I keep it in my house as a practice, because we don't. I mean, it might enter our house once a year when those relatives come over. But the fact that it's there, and we didn't even remember that it was there, I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh, my Lord. You know, alcohol, I was aware of it everywhere. I was aware that you didn't drink your drink, you know, and can I have it if you're not drinking it? It tells us that we will be placed in a position of neutrality. And I am with regard to alcohol, but I believe that's because I've been through the steps. I've taken the steps up to that point and after that point. The insanity with regard to my alcoholism is that now I know the truth about my drinking. I know that when the rubber meets the road, that a drink isn't going to make it better. And I'm not going to try to talk myself into thinking that it is. I used to say, well, you know what, I'm going to pay the price tonight, but I'll stop tomorrow. I never stopped. Last year, my dad got diagnosed with cancer, and now he's fine. But I remember during that period being very afraid and being really upset. You know, a drink never crossed my mind. And I'm not saying that it hasn't in my sobriety. It surely has, and it comes in and it goes out. It's not something I dwell on. I know today that if I were to take a drink, I don't want to lose everything I have. And I don't mean materially. You know, I have, through the amends process, mended those relationships with my family. I want to be of service to my dad when he has cancer, not be somebody that he's got to worry about and say, oh my God, Allison's drunk again. You know, I know, at least right now in this very minute, that taking a drink is not going to make anything better, no matter what it is, whether it is the death of somebody, the birth of somebody, you take your pick. It's not going to make it better. I used to think that it would. Alcohol used to be my solution to me, actually, my living sober. I didn't know how to live sober. I explained that to you. Today, I do know how to live sober. Alcohol is no longer my solution. It's a symptom of my spiritual illness. That's why the whole theory that if you just stop drinking, you'll get better doesn't work. I am spiritually sick. The book tells me that I have a spiritual malady and that I've got to somehow get a connection with a power greater than myself. I never understood that. I was 9 years sober. I was almost divorced. Everything was falling apart around me. When I went to work, I couldn't even do my job. I lost a ton of weight. I was completely stressed out. The two women that I sponsored, one of them hated me. And, I mean, it was just crazy. It was everything. It was like the harder I grasped to hang on to my life, the worse it got. And, I mean, I felt awful. I was thinking of moving. It was just nuts. I didn't want to go to meetings anymore. I didn't even want to look at anybody more. And I went to this step study, and an old acquaintance of mine who I've known, actually, Al and I met him the day we got married, and he did this step study in Richmond, and we're good friends with him, and I asked him if he would take me through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, you know, 9 years sober, everything's falling apart. I feel like crap. I would drive to work. I'd be in tears. I wouldn't even know why I was crying. I just hated myself and my life, and here I am again, you know, 9 years sober. And I said, I don't even have a relationship with the God that you're, you know, so eloquently discussing. And he agreed to help me. And I had all these secrets accumulated. It was crazy. You know, the secrets will get you sick. Find somebody, if you've got any, find somebody that you trust that you can talk to and just unload, even if it is a stranger. You know, walking around with that kind of stuff doesn't do anybody any good. So anyway, he took me through the book, and with the agreement that I would take other people through the book, and then I would also get a different female sponsor, and I did. And I talked earlier about no human power can relieve our alcoholism, but a lot of humans can lead us to the solution. And it's up to me to apply the solution to my life. And I'll be forever grateful to that man and my sponsor today. I don't rely on her to fix what's wrong with me. I was just talking to her this afternoon, actually, about something that was going on with a woman I sponsor, and she was laughing. She said, isn't it so funny how our ego gets in the way and, just all this stuff. And she never tells me specifically what to do. She doesn't want that reliance. She doesn't want me to have to rely on her for every single thing. I mean, that defeats the purpose. What she does is she will direct me back to God, and then I make my own decision. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. Because of AA and the 12 steps and actually taking them, I'm not divorced. I have no power. I will seek power in odd ways. And when I thought I was getting divorced, I would be very angry. I would punish my husband. I wouldn't speak to him. If he wanted to use my car, I would revel in saying, no, I make the car payment. All kinds of mean, nasty stuff. That was my way of gaining power. The better way, the healthier way that the book suggests, is we get power through the God of our understanding. That's where my power supply comes from. And I wish I could say every day that's where my power supply comes from, but sometimes it comes from temper tantrums. I don't know. We use weird stuff to get power. And that's what I was searching for. And I was looking in all the wrong places. And I really believe God puts people in my life that help me access something that's going to be better for me. Better for me than what I even dreamed. I remember the man who took me through the book, Bob. I remember telling him, I said, I feel like my entire life is upside down right now. And I was crying and rambling on. And he said, maybe it's just turning right side up. And you've just been living wrong for so long, and you would know the difference. And I thought, oh, geez. And I think he was right. And, since that experience, wonderful things have happened to me. I mean, the first being my, saving my marriage. I mean, that was wonderful. And all these women have come into my life. And I finished college. I did a whole, not really me doing a whole bunch of stuff. You gave me the power to finish things that I had started and the power to be giving. I'm not naturally giving. My mom, I watched my mom. My mom has a real attachment to material stuff, and she was just visiting about a month ago, and a long time ago, she gave me a bunch of furniture. Well, the last time she left, she took the last piece with her, and, she just can't. She can't give it to somebody and let them have it. She's got to take it back, and I remember thinking, it didn't bother me at all. I'm happy to give it back, but I thought, I'm really thankful that God has taken away that attachment from me, because I remember having that attachment, somebody wanting something that I had and thinking, oh my God, I can't part with this, I need this, and I don't need it, I just want it, I can be a hog by nature, and so many things have happened. The more I give, the better my life gets, and I didn't get that. I remember for several years in here thinking, I need to get mine, and not so much maybe that mindset, but I need to get better, and then I will try to help you. That's not it at all. I remember, I think maybe 6, 7, 8 months ago, I was listening to a woman's fifth step, and she had the same kind of relationship that I had with my mother up until recently, very recently, and, she was just torment, torture, all of it, and then just hating her guts. And I mean, when I was sitting in that woman's living room, listening to her fifth step, I thought, I still can't stand my mom. Well then, oh my Lord. And you never know who you're going to hear. I learn more about me from the women I sponsor than my sponsor telling me what she sees in me. And then this woman went on to tell me how she had healed this relationship, and I'm getting embarrassed. I'm thinking, God, my relationship with my mom is still crappy. And driving home, I mean, it really unnerved me. And driving home, I thought, there is way more to do in this area. I really have just done a half you-know-what job with my mother. And it was all pride and ego. I didn't want to be the first one to give in. I just did not want to give her that satisfaction. In the beginning, I made amends, kind of just so I could tell my sponsor at the time that I had. And that's what it was. I had done some real damage to my mother. I was supposed to take care of her after her surgery. I never even showed up. Her sister had to take care of her. It was just, I mean, some really awful things. And you know, I sort of acknowledged them when I first got sober, but not really. Not in the way they probably really needed to be acknowledged. And so what I had done my entire sobriety is I kept my mom at arm's length. I thought, you know, forget her. If she's going to be this cold woman, then I am going to make her pay. I am going to keep her as far out of my life as I can. I will tell her the bare minimum of information. I won't even tell her where Elle and I are going on vacation. That is the most immature statement. You know, it is. But I would, you know, think this stuff. And so obviously I was still really angry at her. And when I am that seething at somebody, I know I have something to clean up. There is just no doubt about it in my mind. And so, you know, I really tapped into it, but it was because I listened to this woman's fifth step, and I don't think I would have tapped into it if I hadn't have been sitting in that living room that day. I've had all kinds of experiences like that. I've learned a lot about what I could do better in my marriage by listening to women I sponsor. You know, there's just, I learn from everybody. I do not just rely on my sponsor to say, you know, it might be a good idea if you do this. She always tells me to watch and listen. She says, you never know who you're going to be learning from this day. And they could be a day sober. They could be 30 years sober. I don't put much stock in how long people have been sober anymore because I don't know where I'm going to hear it. So anyway, I think, oh, Lord, I told Rich I talk loud, and I guess I talk a lot, too. I do. My journey here has been just absolutely incredible. I do have a relationship with a God in my understanding today. I wish I could say that, oh, yes, I practice all this stuff every day, all day. I don't. I am much better than I used to be. I'm far more disciplined than I used to be about it, but I don't practice it every single day. And, you know, I suffer when I don't, and then I can just get back on the wagon and keep on keeping on again. But I would not have the amazing life I have today if it weren't for you people. So thank you very much, and thank you for having me.